I'm Katie Lauer, and this is the story from the hills of home. I found a picture of John Morris today as I was cleaning out a desk drawer. It was just a snapshot, really, but I stopped and studied it for a long while, resting one hand on my old brown desk. He was a striking man, I thought. With his carrot-colored hair and his startling blue eyes, he looked like a maple leaf in autumn. Although the picture was taken over 25 years ago, I remembered the occasion as if it were yesterday. We were at the United Mine Workers Convention in Denver. John played fiddle with the band I was singing with, and we spent 2 or 3 weeks playing music and exploring the Rocky Mountains, watching bald eagles circle lazily in the sky while white-tailed deer scampered from one pine tree to another. On the day the picture was taken, I was to have met John and the folk singer Utah Phillips at the pie restaurant next to the Denver Hilton Hotel where we were staying. When I went in the front door, there were 4 top tables scattered here and there and rows of pies in a pastry case, among them mile-high pie and a coconut cream with meringue that would make you roll over and beg. I saw them at a corner table, John, a West Virginia fiddler, and Utah, an old-time thump-and-holler socialist, as Utah called himself. We were all part of the entertainment package for the United Mine Workers Convention. Utah was dressed neatly in a lumberjack garb, a union suit showing under his red checked flannel shirt, a bandana tied jauntily at his throat. He was tall and spare, and I noticed his jeans were cut a little shorter than his boots. Loggers wear 'em that way, John told me later. They have to carry spikes in their vests and hammer them into tree trunks with the boots. That's how they go up and down the trees. I flinched a bit, but when I reached the table, Utah stood up in a courtly fashion, and John introduced us. I'm a fan of yours, I said to Utah. I sing 2 of your songs, Rock Salt and Nails and Green Rolling Hills of West Virginia. Well, he said, and he looked pleased in spite of himself. I gave that Rock Salt and Nails to Hazel and Alice for them to record. That was generous, I said. Well, back in my day, it was share and share alike, he said. Giving somebody a song you wrote because it sounded better coming from them than from you made sense, and it was like a little gift, maybe the only one you could afford to give. I bit into a piece of pie and started talking before I could swallow. I almost visited you last fall when I was singing in Spokane, but you were touring back east. Ah, yes, Utah said, best time of the year to tour. I don't do many of the summer festivals anymore. Not many of them want an old socialist. I like to stay close to the farm, to my wife and family. I started out following the hobos, hopping freights, and all of them come through here. And all the bums, well, you could see them everywhere on Larimer Street. He paused for a few seconds and laughed. Hell, he said, it was a bum's paradise. People who had food shared it, eating out of 10 cans of pork and beans, and when things were flush, maybe a tin of Vianney sausage and crackers. Some of the bums could afford an RC Cola. They tore down the old train depot, you know, renovated it, called it a historical area. Utah waved his hands in front of his face in annoyance. Why did all the hobos come to Denver, I asked. And Utah said, oh, all the trains come here then, and then the hobos came on the trains. There used to be a soup kitchen on the corner of 15th and Larimer. They used to hand out soup to the hobos. Yes, sir, he said, all the hobos. John was eating his stew enthusiastically, missing all of this. I wondered whether to nudge him under the table. But John was the kind of man that if you nudged him under the table, he would immediately say, how come you're nudging me under the table? Instead, he reached for Utah's leftover stew. You mind if I finish your stew, he said, and Utah looked surprised. Why, no, I should have offered it to you sooner. I used to stand outside the soup kitchen and sing that song. And he called out fiddle tunes like Buffalo Gals, you just knew were from the mountains. One was sung to the tune of Bring Back My Bonnie to Me. I knew Bring Back My Bonnie, but I wanted to hear Utah sing the soup song. He was still sitting, easy in his own skin, when all of a sudden he sang out loudly, causing people at neighboring tables to look up suddenly. Soup, soup, he sang. Oh, give me a bowl of soup. Then we'd sing eggs in the morning, red meat at night. Utah looked like a biblical prophet with his long, flowing white hair and white beard. John, in contrast, was wearing Sears and Roebuck jeans and his shirt from Monkey Ward's, as he called it in his high, old-timey voice. The shirt was unbuttoned accidentally right above his belt, and his slight beer paunch protruded from his white T-shirt. He looked like most of the miners, though he had never dug coal, he told me once, but had traveled around the country with his brother David and the Morris brothers, playing at union rallies and getting out the vote. They were a high-energy, up-tempo, five-piece band. One of their most requested songs was called The Hog-Eyed Man, an old-timey fiddle tune with the refrain, Sally's in the garden with the hog-eyed man. And listeners and dancers would be still a minute before they burst into wild applause, some of them doing a shuffle step to the rhythm of the old-timey music, the fiddle and the banjo. The driving rhythm was compelling. It made you want to dance. Well, John said to Utah, this one ain't going to be as easy as the convention we did in Pittsburgh. There's some strange things going on. The first night we played, they had free liquor, and everybody run plumb wild. These guys ain't been away from their old ladies in a long time, and there ain't but 50 women in the whole town, far as I've seen. He paused. Feller at the convention the other night allowed us how he'd like to have the concession on hookers. John laughed and took a long swig of coffee. In Pittsburgh, they kept our glasses full at least, but there's tension here. John, David, and Utah were deeply involved in the United Mine Workers. John's and David's band, the Morris Brothers, had followed the campaign trail of UMW notables like Carl Jablonski, getting out support for Jablonski and sorrowing when he was assassinated after winning the presidency of the Union. John and David grieved over Jablonski's death for a long while, but eventually they started playing again, at first as a duo, then gradually morphing into a full-size band. When they stepped up to the mic to play, it was like firecrackers going off, like New Year's Eve, and all of a sudden they were doing shows from Los Angeles to Chicago. When they were in full array, outrageously good, you'd forgive them anything. It was as if you were a cat, and they made your fur stand straight up, then lay down again like a soft carpet. They'd make you purr loudly, spread your claws, and arch your proud neck. Every morning we were in Denver, John got up at 7 a.m. and sat quietly in his room whittling. He carved a Martin D28 guitar with a black shoe polish stain on it to keep me from playing the wrong chords. The pick he carved for me was half black and half natural wood. You always wanted to hit a good G run, he said. Well, this pick will solve your problems. No toolbox would be complete without a magic screwdriver, and John had made me a fine one, stained black, with my initials K on one end and L on the other. On our own, John and I walked through the long, flat streets of Denver that day. I saw hobos sleeping in the glassed-in mall of the May D&F Company, just like Utah had told me I would. And I oohed and aahed over Indians wearing blankets and cowboys in Stetson hats. I stopped at an art gallery and bought two prints by an artist named Harrison Begay. I didn't know his work, but the prints were of Navajos, one dancing, another riding a beautiful pinto pony, and I have kept them close by me for all those years. John sauntered for a while with his hands shoved in his pockets and his cap cocked over one eye like a greenhorn in the old West, his head moving slowly around like a turtle's, taking in the sights. He delighted in throwing me off balance. When I slowed my pace to a stroll, he marched ahead of me, grinning. When we finally got back to the Hilton, we were exhausted, and I went upstairs to take a nap and get ready for the evening's festivities. It's a good thing I saved my strength because the miners had not come down from their party mood. John had called me and said he thought it would be safe that night. Unfortunately, John's assessment had been premature, and I picked up a couple of stalkers in the Hilton elevator. To save myself, I headed for the entertainer's tent on the ground floor. Unfortunately, I found myself in a small room with Al Yankovic's polka band, large men barrel-chested in typical polka band outfits. The purple balloon sleeves of their shirts were so wide they almost swallowed me up. I was saved from further harassment that night by the arrival of the Morris brothers, wearing fringe and deerskins embroidered with tiny beads, and by the presence of Lily Mae Ledford, the only surviving member of the all-woman band, the Coon Creek Girls. Straight and strong, she was wheeled out in a wheelchair with a banjo on her lap. She was old, but she commanded respect from the miners. She said a few words of greeting and began to play her banjo the old-time clawhammer way. The miners gathered around her in a semicircle while she whipped into Banjo Pickin' Girl, which had been the theme song of the Coon Creek Girls back when they were the first female band to appear at the White House. I'm going to Carolina, baby mine. I'm going to Carolina, baby mine. I'm going to Carolina, and from there I'm going to China. I'm going to Carolina, baby mine. I'm going to Carolina, baby mine. On the last note of the song, she lifted the banjo and twirled it around. The applause was deafening, and I felt relieved. If Lily Mae's set went all right, surely mine would. And it started out lively and upbeat. Somewhere, though, I took a wrong turn and did a song that was too slow. Country Roads, a man yelled. It was the John Denver song about West Virginia, and I had never bothered to learn it. I'm sorry, I'm afraid I don't know that one. Well, just hum it then, he said. The band doesn't know it either. Look, honey, he said, his voice calm and level. It made me think everything was going to be all right after all. Honey, he repeated, if you don't play Country Roads, I'm going to cut your banjo player's guts out. I looked around in vain for security, but there was none. We started out to play the song as well as we could remember it, but we were in a cold sweat. The bass player knew most of the chords and called them out to us. We played the chorus out front, and then I attempted to sing the song. Almost heaven, I warbled. West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains. From then on, I hummed, and mercifully, that audience started singing the next few lines and filled in where I left off. After our set was over, the band walked slowly back to our rooms and agreed that we hadn't really known the meaning of stage fright until that moment. The next day was bright and beautiful, and we got dressed and rented a car to explore the Rocky Mountains. In those years, there was a company called Rent-A-Lemon, and it cost $10 or $20 to rent a car, which couldn't be guaranteed to make it back to the lot in one piece. I think we ended up with a Chevy Impala with old-fashioned hardware on the inside, a cigarette lighter, and a large ashtray to start. Nevertheless, we were happy to have our own wheels. The United Mine Workers had flown us out on a chartered plane, and this was the first independence we had tasted. We drove toward Golden, Colorado to visit an old Ohio friend, David Harvey, a luthier and a magnificent mandolin player. He and his wife lived in a cabin in a rural area, and since we had brought our instruments anyway, we began playing, jamming, bouncing licks off each other. Something about the air was exhilarating, and we played as well as we had ever done. I did a 20-minute clog dance set and was barely out of breath. We were reluctant to leave in mid-afternoon, but the gig was calling. So we sat and gossiped a few minutes, catching up on old friends near and far away. When the last story was told, the last beer bottle thrown away, we cased our instruments and said so long, and our host said travel safely, and we hit the road for Denver, gasping all over again at the Rocky Mountains. The car was running a little rough. We knew if it broke down, we were to pull into a rest stop with a telephone. This was before cell phones. And a new car and driver would be sent to us as quickly as possible. We breathed a sigh of relief on our arrival at the Hilton, safe, sound, and with an hour to grab our instruments, get dressed, and play the evening show. On our last night in Denver, we all gathered in a private room at the hotel and played gospel music. There were about 30 of us there that night, some of the best of what traditional music had to offer. Lily Mae Ledford came, and Hazel Dickens, the Red Clay Ramblers, my favorite band of all time, showed up, as well as Billy Joe Shaver, who was beginning to enjoy some attention for his recordings. Jeanette Carter, the daughter of Sarah and A.P. Carter, came in with her auto harp and did one of the Carter family songs she'd learned as a child. She had actually traveled with A.P., Sarah, and Maybelle as a tiny dancing girl. They'd put her on a table and she'd clog to the music to the delight of her audiences. We finished the last song. It was I'll Fly Away, or at least I hope it was, because the next morning we were due to leave Denver on the same plane which had brought us in the first place. We hugged each other, not knowing when we'd meet again, and rubbed the shoulders of the fiddlers whose arms were nearly numb. Thanks for listening to this memory from the hills of home. I'm Katie Lauer.